Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower, right after this message. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th in order to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, the average American had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us? And this income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, and it includes our English common law. The income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. The Social Security tax is the eighth plank. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order yours right now by simply calling direct, 417-273-4967, or if you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Parthia, the ancient superpower. You know, most Scythian names do not exactly reflect the names of Israelite tribes because of the names of such Greco-Roman historians. Or they are names which the Greco-Roman historians have given them during the centuries after the tribes of Israel left Palestine. And even so, several names besides their common names, or Saki, that's spelled S-A-C-A-E, have recognizable Israelitish origins. The Massagetae, as explained in chapter 6 of the previous book, were the Israelite tribe of Manasseh. The Dahae may have been part of the tribe of Dan. The Tokhari likely descended from the Israelite tribe of Issachar, as Tola was one of the clans of Issachar. You see that in Numbers 26, verse 23. So when we combine the syllables from the names Tola and Issachar, results the term Tokhari, T-O-C-H-A-R-I. The Khosrasmi, that is C-H-O-R-A-S-M-I-I, Khorasmi, exhibit a name based on the root word of a clan of the tribe of Reuben, called the Carmites. We see that in Numbers 26, verse 6. And on this specific case of ancient root words, I wish to acknowledge the help of the late Dr. Charles Dorothy. He was a graduate of the Claremont Graduate School, for pointing out that such a relationship is possible. Since Carmite of Numbers 26 uses the Hebrew C-A-P-H, sometimes translated C-C-H-K or K-H. Now, on the other hand, Rawlinson records that Karazme were a clan of the Mazagati, and they may have been named after the Makurites, a clan of the tribe of Manasseh. You will see that in Numbers 26, verse 29. The Sakurli, S-A-C-A-R-U-L-I, cannot be identified with a particular tribe of Israel, but their Israelite origin is attested by the fact that they are known by the name of Isaac. Now, these tribes migrating into Parthia were the Scythians, who had lived in the steppes east of the Caspian Sea. Now, the Saki Scythians, who lived in the Black Sea and Caucasus Mountain regions, were not involved in this migration. Now, while this large infusion of kinsmen into Parthia's empire greatly increased its strength, it needs to be understood that Parthia was not a monolithic Israelite empire consisting of just the tribes of Israel. There were many native populations who were not Israelites. Medes, Persians, Babylonians, Elamites, Assyrians, and others, even though they were located within the Parthian Empire. Another large mass of people, called the Yuchi, was being pushed out of Asia towards Scythia and Parthia. Early Chinese chronicles record that the Ephthalites were one of the tribes of the Yuchi. The Ephthalites were also called White Huns, because they were fair-skinned, indicating a Semitic origin. Byzantine writers also called them Hephthalites or Naphthalites, although the Encyclopedia Britannica adds an editorial comment that the initial N of Naphthalite is believed to be a clerical error. It's easy for anyone with even a slight biblical knowledge to identify this tribe as the Israelite tribe of Naphtali. The consonants of Ephthali or Naphtali precisely match the very unique name of Naphtali, one of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. I might make an editorial comment here. The National Geographic had an article about whites being buried in China, and they were recently discovered in China. Graves of red-headed, red-bearded European people who have been dug up in China. And of course the question arises, well, where did those people come from and how did they get there? Well, you can see right here that the Israelites migrated in two directions from Palestine when they were destroyed by the Assyrians in 721 B.C. They went west to Carthage and they went east. The eastern groups of Israelites held an empire all the way from India, from Palestine over to India. The western Israelites settling in Carthage migrated into Spain, Britain, Ireland, Scotland, and had, even from the time of Solomon, expeditions and colonies that stretched clear to the New World. They were cut off from the New World during the period called the Dark Ages, and it was Columbus that rediscovered the New World in 1492. Israelites had been over here in the New World for thousands of years before Columbus set sail in 1492. Going on, and I might point out that this is Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History, written by Stephen Collins. It's a 1 in 100 read. It's published by Bible Blessings, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. That's Bible Blessings, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. That P.O. Box 1778. And you can get to them on the web at www.BibleBlessings.net. Again, that's www.BibleBlessings.com. Now, it's amusing that the Encyclopedia Britannica observed that the Byzantines, who recorded that this tribe's name began with an N, are believed to have made a clerical error. It offered no evidence indicating that it was a clerical error, but it is believed to be one. Why? Well, because the establishment historians have a very strong bias against finding any of the lost tribes of Israel, because for doing so would affirm the Bible and compel a dramatic pro-biblical shift in our view of the world history. While many Israelite tribal names can be found in Asia, the similarity between the Asian Naphtalites and one of the lost tribes of Israel, the Naphtalites, is very glaringly obvious. And the presence of a tribe in Asia bearing an Israelite tribal name, unchanged from biblical times, is an academic hot potato. A belief that the N is an ancient clerical error helps obscure the Israelite nature of this tribe. Indeed, if establishment histories were to examine other Scythian or Parthian history in very much depth at all, their identity as the 10 tribes of Israel would be impossible to miss. The fact that the Ephthalites were fair-skinned, Semitic or Caucasian, further verifies their identification as Israelites in Asia. Since the Israelites were all Semites, that the Ephelites were called White Huns indicates that while they came out of Asia, they were differentiated from the other Huns who were not fair or white-skinned. Indeed, the Encyclopedia Britannica refers to the Sakis, S-A-K-A-S, or Saki, Scythians, the Yuchi, and the Ephelites as related Indo-Scythian tribes. And we find evidence of them to this day up as far as China. Now, the Bible provides the answer as to why the tribes of Naphtali, the Machirite clan of Manasseh, and parts of Dan, Issachar, and Reuben, for example, the Naphtalites, Masagadi, the Karazmi, Dahi, Pekari, etc., would be located together as a group of allied tribes in Asia. In 2 Kings 15, verse 29, it tells us that about 20 years prior to Samaria's fall, the Assyrians invaded Israel and carried captive the entire tribe of Naphtali and those Israelites living in Gilead and Galilee. This occurred in approximately 740 B.C., and 1 Chronicles 5, verse 26 reveals that Gilead included one half of the tribe of Manasseh and the tribes of Reuben and Gad. Numbers 26, verse 29 further shows us that the half-tribe of Manasseh, which lived in Gilead, was the Machirites. And a look at a biblical atlas will confirm that the tribes of Issachar and Asher and a portion of Dan lived next to Naphtali in the region of Galilee. And portions of these tribes would have gone captive with the entire tribe of Naphtali. The Assyrians relocated the tribes of Naphtali, Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and portions of other tribes eastward into their empire. Many of these Israelites migrated to the east of the Caspian Sea after the Assyrian Empire fell. The Masagadi and their allied tribes in that area annihilated the army of Cyrus the Great around 530 B.C. After living east of the Caspian Sea for half of a millennium, they migrated southward into Parthia's empire. Now, the Book of Tobit claims to tell the experiences of a family of Naphtalites in Tobit 1, verses 1 and 2. After the Assyrians resettled them in Assyria and in the cities of the Medes, while Tobit is an apocryphal, non-canonized book, its historical context makes it plausible reading for this time period. Tobit 1, verse 21 parallels 2 Kings 19, verse 37. In mentioning the death of the Assyrian king Sennacherib at the hands of his sons, who then fled to Ararat in Armenia, where they sought refuge. Tobit 14:12-15 states that Naphtalites lived in Ecbatana, that's Ecbatana, Ecbatana, in Media, when Nineveh fell. This is consistent with secular history, as Ecbatana is named as a city of the Scythians who lived in Media during the fall of the Assyrian Empire. The same people called Naphtalites in the book of Tobit, written from an Hebrew perspective, are called Scythians in secular accounts written from a non-Hebrew perspective. When the Assyrian Empire fell, many of their formerly subject peoples were suddenly free to migrate to new locations. One such people were the Israelites, including the tribe of Naphtali, and one group of them migrated to the steppes east of the Caspian Sea. The half-tribe of Manasseh stayed in that region, but the tribe of Naphtali went even further into Asia. However, they still bore their Israelite tribal name, and centuries later, when they migrated out of Asia toward Parthia, they retained that name. The migration of the Mazagadi and the Naphtalites toward Parthia was not a coincidence. As they were pressured by other Asiatic tribes, they would logically retrace the historic routes that their ancestors had followed into Asia. The connection is becoming very clear. The Mazagadi, the Saki, or Saki, and the Ephthalites were related clans of the 10 tribes of Israel who had been taken captive from Gilead and Galilee around 740 BC by the Assyrians. Now, while many settled in the eastern portion of the Parthian Empire, some Saki tribes founded a kingdom of their own in the region of the Indus River. And historical accounts indicate that a large body of the Naphtalites apparently remained outside the borders of the Parthian Empire. It's likely that a tribe of Naphtali retained its exact Israelite name over many centuries because it was taken captive in one entire group. Other tribes, which left Palestine in a piecemeal fashion, came to be known by their appropriate clan names. Now, since the Ephraimite role in the formation of Parthia was discussed earlier in this narrative, this infusion of Scythian Israelites meant that the Parthian Empire came to include a large portion of the tribe of Ephraim, one half of the tribe of Manasseh, the tribes of Reuben and Gad, and portions of the tribes of Issachar. Asher, Dan, and Naphtali, while Gad is unnamed among the Scythians, it was likely present with the Mazagadi as Gad migrated into Asia with the half-tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Reuben. Since many Jews of the house of Judah had lived in the region of the Parthian Empire from the time of the Assyrian and Medo-Persian empires, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were present as well. The tribe of Levi was also in Parthia because there were Levites among the Jews, as we read in Ezra 1 verse 5, and the Parthian priestly tribe, called the Magi, may have been the hereditary Levites. Not all the tribes of Israel lived in Parthia. The Black Sea Scythians and the Iberians, the Caucasus region, where large bodies of independent Israelites led by other half of the tribe of Manasseh, the main bodies of the tribes of Asher, Issachar, Simeon, and contingents of the other tribes. A large body of the tribe of Dan was also present along the Black Sea, and among the Black Sea Scythians, as the rivers emptied into the Black Sea, were all named after the tribe of Dan when the Scythians occupied that region after the fall of the Kingdom of Israel. This was discussed in greater detail in the previous book in this series. However, at this time, there were even more scattered Israelites in the world, and the Israelite, Phoenician, and Carthaginian empires had various colonies in Spain, the British Isles, and Europe. When those empires fell, the survivors in their scattered colonies became independent, and thereafterwards were known as the Celts, as was discussed in the previous book in this series. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when you have an income of $50,000, you're paying about $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance? You know, instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 a second time. But you and I both know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of the $50,000 first in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay an additional 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. Now that means you're paying 17% of the $7,650 twice. Once at 15% and the second time at 17%. And this little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everyone who pays this tax. What would you think if Sears Pennies or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that was just real special. And if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Remember that's 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package, would you? That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And tax and status is also available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. We're reviewing a book called Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by Stephen Collins. It's the fourth in a series of books that Collins has written on Israelite history. This Israelite history is the history of the Bible. Bible prophecy. You can get a copy. It's a 1 in 100 read from Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. That's P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068. You can get them on the website at www.BibleBlessings.net. Again, that's www.BibleBlessings.net. All right, Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower. The Israelite character of the Parthian Empire is well documented. The wars between the Roman and the Parthian empires will be much more interesting to read when it is realized that the Parthian Empire was dominated by the reunited and revitalized tribes of Israel, ruling over native populations who had previously been Israel's captors. Now, there's a story about the Roman-Parthian wars. You see, the Roman-Parthia did not initially come into contact with each other as enemies. For several centuries, the Seleucid Greek Empire had separated them. When Parthia replaced the Seleucids as the dominant Asian empire, Rome seized the western portion of the Seleucid Empire. The kingdom of Armenia, which then had a large domain in Asia Minor, still served as a buffer state between the Roman and Parthian empires. Rome became embroiled in a war with Armenia, while Parthia tried to remain neutral. Parthia's neutral policy finally became untenable, and the Parthians ended the war on the side of the Romans. Rome, in the person of Pompey, offered Parthia an alliance with the promise that Rome would respect Parthia's right to have certain territories as her portion for assisting the Romans. Well, after the war was over, the Romans reneged on their word and resisted the Parthians when they tried to occupy their promised portion of the conquered territory. It kind of reminds me of the Russians and the Germans dividing up Poland prior to World War II. Pompey also insulted the Parthian monarchs, Phraates III, by refusing to address him at the customary Parthian, or by the customary Parthian title of King of Kings. Rawlinson comments on this episode that Phraates learned that Roman promises were worthless. Note that this Parthian king Phraates had a name that included the Hebrew root word for Pharaohs, or Pharaohs, the dynastic line of David and the kings of Judah. From this very first Parthian-Roman contact about 62 BC, the Euphrates River became the border between these two great empires. Earlier we noted that binding one's word with a handshake was viewed as a sacred bond of commitment among the Parthians. Now, being true to one's word was critically important in Parthian society. Once a Parthian king offered to meet with two rebels under a guarantee of security that included sending his right hand to them by way of his ambassador. This then signified that even the Parthian king was bound to observe any agreement that involved shaking hands. Indeed, offering his right hand to the rebels was the highest degree of security that he could give them, because honoring one's word was so high in value in Parthian society. Now, the case with which the Romans broke their word caused the Parthians to see the Romans as an untrustworthy, barbarian society. So when we look at the pagan splendor of Rome and its barbaric nature as compared to the Parthians and the Israelites, isn't it the same today when you compare China with the United States or Britain with Russia? Who are, in fact, the barbarians? Now, earlier we noted that binding one's word with a handshake was viewed as a sacred bond of commitment among the Parthians. Phraates III was assassinated by his sons, and Mithridates and Orodes and the former, then banishing the latter. The Parthian nobles, the wise men, the Magi, later deposed Mithridates because of his harsh rule and recalled Orodes from banishment to be the new king. The wise men and the Magi were powerful enough at this time, around 56 BC, to dethrone a monarch that they disliked. Now, there's another parallel to modern American and European societies in the fact that the Parthian Empire could be recalled, or the emperor could be recalled, by the Magistanes, the bicameral body of the king's kinsmen, and the Senate of the Magi and the nobility. American presidents can be impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives and tried by the Senate, as happened to President Clinton. European governments having a parliamentary system can also be overturned by the government losing a no-confidence vote in parliament. It's a remarkable fact of ancient Parthia that its monarchs could be removed from office by the very people who had put the monarchs in office in the first place. Now, the first Roman-Parthian war resulted from Roman aggression. Crassus, who ruled Rome in a triumvirate with Julius Caesar and Pompey, sought wealth and fame by attempting to subjugate Parthia. The Greco-Roman biographer Plutarch recorded that Crassus, C-R-A-S-U-S, invaded Parthia because he was envious of Julius Caesar's war record and wanted to be honored like Caesar. Plutarch also records that Julius Caesar wrote to Crassus from Gaul expressing his approval of the project and encouraging him to enter upon the war. Plutarch recorded that Julius Caesar even detached 1,000 cavalrymen from his own forces for Crassus for his invasion of Parthia. You're listening to the Law Hour Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack, 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. You know, governments tax us all, and in fact, they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms, but what does our government do to produce, prepare, or deliver for which it gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on a pizza that they buy? You know, they have to buy the ingredients to make it, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store where you eat it. And why does the government get paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Four-hour commentary. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, for more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for that free general law CD package. Now, if you're online, you can get the material online by simply going to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, a blockbuster book written by Stephen Collins. It's a 1 in 100 read. There's nothing like it anywhere. He's written a series of 6 books. He's completed 4. He's in the process of writing the final 2 on the Lost 10 Tribes of Israel. Indeed, it's an exposé of the tribes of Israel, the Jews, and the distinctions between the two. This is the ancient empire of the Parthians. There was the ancient Israelite empire of the Carthaginians. You've heard about Hannibal. Hannibal was an Israelite. Carthage was an Israelite colony. After the Israelites were destroyed by the Assyrians about 721 BC, they were dispersed from Palestine. The Jews remained for a number of years, and then they were conquered. They were deported, and then they returned under Ezra and Nehemiah. But the Israelites never returned. The Israelites established 2 empires, one to the west and one to the east. The one to the east is the one that we're reading about now, Parthia. The one to the west, Carthage, had trading colonies all over the Atlantic Ocean. They were trading as far back into Solomon's day, as far as the Midwestern United States, as far west as Denver, Colorado, and as far south as Brazil. Brazil, which was called Iron Land. And they were bringing copper from Michigan, iron from Brazil, to smelting facilities that we can view in Israel, in Palestine, to this day. Now, those pieces of history are reviewed in former books. We're on book number 4, Parthia. Or book number 3. I've forgotten now whether this is the 3rd or the 4th book. Parthia, the Ancient Superpower. Stephen Collins. Remember, that's BibleBlessings.net. Now, to help our modern readers gain a perspective on Crassus, he was the Roman general who defeated the slave army of Spartacus. Remember Spartacus, a gladiator who revolted against Rome. This revolt is the subject of the epic movie called Spartacus. Crassus, flush with victory, marched eastward toward Parthia in search of glory and plunder. And in the words of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Crassus, greedily and greedy of wealth and jealous of military renown, set out for the east, determined to make war on the Parthians, although they had given Rome no provocation. The Parthians were simply minding their own business when the Romans charged into their territory looking for plunder to satisfy Crassus' pride and avarice. Readers might ask themselves, well, who were the real barbarians in this war? Well, obviously it was the Romans, who acted in a barbarian fashion, and the Parthians played the civilized role. Well, the campaign of Crassus was the first of many Roman-Parthian wars that typically occurred as a result of Roman aggression against Parthia. The Encyclopedia Britannica makes this further comment about this initial war and the whole history of the Parthian-Roman wars. He said, quote, "Thus the wars between Parthia and Rome proceeded not from the Parthians, but from Rome herself." Parthia was forewarned of this invasion and made preparations to defend itself. After defeating some weak buffer kingdoms, Crassus turned to looting the wealth of the Middle East. Full of avarice, he stole all of the gold and treasure that he could find. He even looted the temple of God at Jerusalem, stealing an immense amount of gold. The largest piece being recorded, according to Josephus, a solid gold beam of 750 pounds. Now, the Jewish high priest had offered Crassus this beam of gold in exchange for Crassus sparing the rest of the temple's treasures. Crassus agreed, but in typical Roman fashion broke his oath and carried away all of the gold that was in the temple. Now, this was the greatest sacrilege in the temple of God since Antiochus Epiphanes offered pig's blood in the temple to profane it. The reader may choose to see divine justice in what transpired next. Soon after Crassus' sacrilege in violating the temple of God in Jerusalem, he lost his life in one of the greatest military defeats in Rome's history. Parthia, the Assyrian or Asian empire of the 10 tribes of Israel, the birthright tribes of the God, whose temple in Jerusalem had now been violated, would administer poetic justice to the Roman Crassus. Crassus was more interested in looting the weak than in seriously invading Parthia. Parthia, now well prepared for war and eager to teach the Romans a lesson, taunted Crassus with a message that was intended to so inflame his vanity that he would seek a battle. So the Parthians sent Crassus this provocative message. Here's what it reads. Quote, "If the war was really waged by Rome, it must be fought to the bitter end. But if, as they had good reason to believe, Crassus had attacked Parthia and seized her territory for his own private gain, Arsaces, the Parthian king, would have pity on the advanced years of the proconsul." Remember, Crassus was over 70 years old and would give the Romans back those men of theirs who were not so much keeping watch in Mesopotamia as having watched or kept watch being kept on them. Crassus, stung with this taunt, exclaimed that he would return the ambassadors an answer in Seleucia, a large city near the Parthian capital. Now, Wigasus, the chief Parthian ambassador, glad to heap taunt upon taunt, replied, striking the palm of one hand with his fingers, with the fingers of his other hand, "Hairs will grow here, Crassus, before you see Seleucia." And we have that saying to this day. The guy is so lazy that he grows hair on the palms of his hands. If you've ever heard that taunt, the guy is so lazy that he grows hair on the palms of his hand, comes from this taunt in ancient times. Now, Crassus, infuriated by these insults, Crassus drove his army toward the Parthian forces, but he was deceived into thinking that the Parthians were fearful and retreating. But in reality, a very powerful force of Parthian cavalry awaited the Romans. Parthia's cavalry was commanded by Serenus, a noble of the Serene family that crowned Parthian monarchs. Now, the Roman invaders consisted of 39,000 infantry and 4,000 cavalry. Sending so small an army to invade an empire the size of Parthia confirms Crassus had seriously underestimated the Parthians. To understand what the Romans were up against, you must realize the fearsome nature of the Parthian cavalry. This was no wild mob from the steppes, but rather it was a very well-disciplined and a very well-prepared military force, and indeed the Romans were warned about the Parthians' capabilities. Plutarch wrote that Crassus received this warning. It said, "Their armored cavalry has weapons which will cut through everything and defensive equipment which will stand up to any blow." Now, the Parthians had both a heavy cavalry and a light cavalry. The light cavalry was composed of fleet horses with riders armed with bows and arrows. These horsemen could rain down upon an enemy a continuous barrage of arrows while riding in shifts, with each troop resupplying itself from camel-borne arrow carriers. Now, when their supply became exhausted in battle, they simply resupplied themselves with new arrows from their supply lines behind the main battle line. Now, the heavy cavalry must have been truly frightening to the Roman legionaries. Rawlinson describes them in the following manner. He said, "The strong horses selected for this service were clad almost wholly in mail. Their head, neck, chest, even their sides and flanks were protected by scale armor of brass or iron. Their riders had cuirasses and cuirasses, that is, breastplates and leg armor of the same materials, and helmets of burnished iron. For an offensive weapon, they carried a long and strong spear or spike. They formed a serried line in battle, bearing down with great weight on the enemy whom they charged, and standing firm as an iron wall against the charges that were made up against them." This is a description of what we see in medieval Europe with the knights, heavily armored with a long spear, the knights of the Middle Ages. The Romans were opposed by a phalanx of armored Parthian cavalry with their armored mounts, body armor, and long spears. The Parthian heavy cavalry must have looked like mounted knights from Europe's medieval period. Again, we see another parallel between the ancient Parthians and Europeans of the feudal period. The Parthian heavy cavalry was like a huge formation of feudal knights armed for combat. Indeed, the Encyclopedia Britannica even described the Parthian heavy cavalry as knights, spelled with a K. Having a mail-clad army was a trait of several ancient Mideast peoples, including the Israelites. We see that in 2 Chronicles 26:14. Judah's king Uzziah, of the lineage of Pharaohs and David, as well as the ancestor of the Arsacid kings of Parthia, equipped his army with shields, spears, and helmets, coats of mail, and bows. Now, you put Uzziah's armored Israelite troops on mounts, and you have a good forerunner of the Parthian cavalry. Rome's own writers acknowledged that the Roman commander, Cassius, was driven by greed and ambition to invade Parthia. What do we know about the Parthian commander? Plutarch, the famous Greek biographer of Roman leaders, writes this about Serenus, or Serena, the Parthian leader who opposed Crassus. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when you want to buy something, you have to go out and earn some money. Let's suppose you wanted to buy something for $1,200, say a used motorcycle. You'd have to go out and earn $1,600, pay a $400 tax, that's about a 25% tax, to net $1,200, so that you could buy this used motorcycle. Now, after you bought this used motorcycle, the guy that takes the $1,200 from you has to pay his 25% tax, that's $300, which leaves him with $900. So he goes out with $900 and buys something in the marketplace. Remember, he had to pay his 25% tax. That leaves him with $675. He spends his $675. The guy that receives it has to pay his 25% tax, which then leaves the next guy in the chain with $506, which then goes to the sixth guy, who is left with $379, the seventh guy with $284, the tenth guy is left with $120. That means when you go out and earn $1,600, by the time that $1,600 has been bought and traded, sold, bought, sold, and traded 10 times, the government has 95% of it. That's right. The government in tax at 25% tax takes 95% of it in 10 transactions. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available in compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by Stephen Collins. It's a 1-in-100 read. You can get more information about it from www.BibleBlessings.net. www.BibleBlessings.net costs about $20. So far, I've bought his first four books. I found each one fascinating. They are well footnoted. They have their bibliographies from a source of information. I mean, a large source of information. Let me give you a couple of ideas, a couple of illustrations. McClintock, Rawlinson, Josephus, Strabo, the Encyclopedia Britannica. And of course, there's many other citations in here. I'm trying to pick out Plutarch, Crassus. And who else in here? Well, these are some of them. Now, there's 116 pages covered by 137 citations. And quotations are well documented. Young's Analytical Concordance to the Bible, Strong's Concordance, and a whole host and plethora of others. And you can have the book for about $20. $20. Just go to Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. The Roman attack on a fortified city, Cyrena, in wealth, birth, and in the honor paid to him, ranked next after the king. When he traveled about the country on his own affairs, he was always accompanied by a baggage train of 1,000 camels. Get this, 1,000 camels, 200 wagons carried his harem, 1,000 armored cavalry, and still more light armored cavalry acted as his escort. The total number of his cavalry, his vassals, and his slaves came to at least 10,000 men, and that's just when he moved around. He had, as an ancient privilege of his family, the right to be the first to set the crown on the head of a king of Parthia at his coronation. This was a Bill Gates in all of his regalia. Serenus, a high-ranking member of Parthia's nobility, did not travel light. The huge size of his entourage was not just what he took to war, but was what he always took with him on his own personal and private affairs. This precedent that members of the Parthian nobility routinely traveled with immense entourages and large bodies of armored cavalry will become of vital importance in the next chapter when we examine the traveling entourage of the Magi, who were also part of Parthia's noble classes. The invading Romans met the Parthian defenders at the Battle of Carrhae, that's C-A-R-R-H-A-E, maybe that's pronounced Carrhae or Carrhae, in 53 BC, near the modern border of Syria and Turkey. The overconfident Romans invaded Parthia, thinking that they would easily defeat the barbarian Parthians. But the well-prepared Parthians knew that they were going to win. In fact, the Parthians were so certain of victory that they split their forces, and they only sent the cavalry to engage Crassus. The Parthian king took his infantry into the mountainous region of Armenia to prevent its king from joining the Romans. The Parthians waged an expert disinformation campaign against the Romans. They used the friendly Arab chieftain to confide to Crassus that the Parthians were so terrified of the Romans that they were retreating to the depths of Scythia. The Romans took the bait and advanced to their deaths. The ruse that the Parthians were retreating all the way to Scythia is further evidence that the close relationship between the Parthians and the Scythians was well known to all of the people of that time. Whether they were friends or enemies of Parthia, if the Parthians were truly terrified of the Romans, they would logically have sought refuge with their brother tribes in Scythia. However, Crassus would soon learn that Parthia so discounted Roman fighting abilities that it had seen no need to call on the Scythian allies for this war for any help at all. Now, when these two forces finally met, the Parthians suckered the Romans into thinking that the Parthians were a ragtag barbarian force. Plutarch gives this account of the battle's opening act. Serena had hidden his main force behind the front ranks and had ordered them to cover themselves with coats and skins so as to conceal the glittering of their armor. The Parthians make use of hollow drums. They beat on these drums all at once in many different parts of the field, and the sound produced is most eerie and terrifying. The Parthians knew how to wage psychological war as well as physical war on the Romans, first preying on their emotions by way of the sense of hearing. The Parthians next disheartened the Romans by way of the sense of sight, and Plutarch continues, before the Romans had recovered from their consternation at this din, the Parthians, suddenly dropping the coverings of their armor, now they could be seen clearly, their helmets and their breastplates blazing like fire in the sun, their steel glittering keen and bright, their horses armored with plates of bronze and steel. That was Plutarch's description of the battlefield as the two armies met. This had a very negative effect on Roman morale. When the battle began, it turned into a massacre of the seven Roman legions that were with Crassus. The Parthians astounded the Romans with the force of their arrows, which penetrated Roman shields and armor. Plutarch recorded the Parthians increased their arrows' velocity by using specially curved great bows. The Parthians apparently had recurved their bows, which modern archers will understand as a design increasing the penetrating power of arrows. The Romans tried to pull the Parthian knights off their horses as they could not fight well on the ground, encumbered by all of their heavy armor. Well, Crassus had a chance to save his own life. At a brief conference between the two commanders, Serena held out his right hand to Crassus and then demanded that the terms of a peace treaty be put into writing, saying, we find that you Romans have not got very good memories about the terms of our peace treaties. Plutarch does not indicate that Crassus accepted the offer of a handshake, at least with Serena and the Parthians, or the Parthians would have seen this as a severe insult by Crassus, and the fighting soon resumed. So the Romans suffered one of the worst defeats in the history of the Roman Empire. Half the 40,000-man army perished, a quarter fled, and 10,000 Romans were captured. Crassus, a member of the triumvirate ruling the Roman Empire, was slain, and the head of the right hand of his corpse was cut off. Now, cutting off Crassus' right hand symbolized Parthia's view that Rome could not be trusted to keep its word, since shaking right hands was like an inviolable oath with the Parthians. and the Parthians also captured the imperial standards of the vanquished Roman legions, a de facto testimony to Parthian supremacy over Rome, which was particularly galling to the Romans. I might point out right here that when I was a boy, in 1955, 15 years old, I had an opportunity to observe this very custom. When I was a youngster, we didn't write contracts like we do today. We didn't have lawyers running around writing contracts for people because people's word meant something. And I observed Frank Rocha shake hands with Elias Sousa. And he said, "Tuesday, I will be there with 3 tractors and 3 wagons and 6 men to help you move hay." Now, on Tuesday morning, Frank was there with the tractors, with the wagons, and with the hired help to help Sousa move 20 acres of hay. It was about 4,000 bales, as I recall, and we moved them all in one day. I mean, we put that hay in the barn in one day. Not only was it in one day, it was put in between milkings. We got there at 10 o'clock, and at 3:30 in the afternoon, we left. We had to go home to milk. Now, of course, Sousa was there with his 4 boys, and he had his tractors and wagons, and we were all working together. But I want to point out to you that that was done on a handshake. And when the job was done, you can rest assured that Sousa wrote a check and paid Rocha. And then there was a reciprocity that came from. You know, Israelites have a reciprocity. It's a reciprocity standard. What you do for me, we return the favor. And when somebody invites you over to dinner, you invite them over for dinner. When somebody comes over and moves your hay, you come over and help him move his hay. And Sousa came over and helped us move our hay. And you can best well bet that when Frank wrote the check and paid him, it was paid in full. A man's word was his bond. When a man spoke, he meant it. Now, there was one exception on that road. His name was Hermann Slate. He was a German fella, a drunk, an alcoholic. Nobody would do business with Hermann Slate. I never worked at the Slate farm, and I never saw any of the Slates come over to help anybody else. Hermann Slate was a hermit. I mean, nobody had anything to do with him. And I asked Frank Rocha about that. I said, "Frank, why is it that no one will deal with Hermann Slate?" And he said, "Because his word is no good. His word is no good." That was 1955. In America today, if somebody tells me that they're going to do something, I don't believe them. Today, a handshake doesn't mean much. And of course, today everybody wants contracts written, signed, sealed, and enforced by the local sheriff or by the attorneys. You know, you've got to have a contract written up now. That's because in America today, people's word is no good. Just like the Romans, their word was no good. Well, so much for the commentary on America today. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log, a schedule of archives, and it can be accessed through the website georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School. The number, 417-273-4967. Or go to georgegordon.org. Hey, there's the signal. It says our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. We'll take it up right there next time. So until then, good night, friends.